Revenue for May 16th, 2007 will come to order. Colleagues, we're 7 minutes late, so we're going to have to move right along. I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2530. Colleagues, on House Bill 2530, we have received a new amendment that takes care of the issues that we raised yesterday. Paul, would you describe that briefly to us?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to mention one thing first
that's
indirectly related, and we just distributed the unofficial preliminary results for the voter turnout yesterday on the counties who had local options, mostly for public safety on the ballot, and the timber-dependent counties. I know the committee's done a lot of work in that area, and you can see the results there, obviously, there's some concern in some of those counties in terms of their impact on their budgets. The amendments on 2530, the dash 3, is identical to the dash 2 that you saw yesterday, with one exception, and that is on page 2, lines 14 through 18. List the number of members from each chamber, and what this amendment does is it increases the number from 2 to 4 from the House and from 2 to 4 from the Senate. So that's the only change from the dash 2s from yesterday.
And in addition to that, as I understand it, we have a request that this bill go to Ways and Means because there will be a fiscal attached to funding the commission and the council. And with that, is there a motion? Representative Berger?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2530.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the dash 3 amendments. Is there discussion? Is there any objection to the dash 3 amendments? If not, the dash 3 amendments are adopted. Representative Berger?
Let me get the wording. I move House Bill 2530 as amended to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Yeah, that's right.
With a due pass recommendation.
Yep. Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 2530 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Discussion? I'm not seeing any. Call the roll, please.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused. Excused.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Excused.
Representative
Witt.
Aye.
And Chair Bowman. Aye. The motion having obtained the required majority, we haven't gaveled it down yet. Representative Rosenbaum, we're voting on sending House Bill 2530 to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. This is the bill that establishes the commission.
Oh.
How do you vote?
I vote aye.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum votes aye. And with that, the motion is passed to send the bill to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2530. Thank you very much. We have a number of other bills to work, but we're not going to do that now because we have a number of people here for the information meeting, and we're hoping to hear for a little bit from those who are involved in education, especially higher education, community colleges, about the current budget situation and some of their long-term plans. And I think Mr.
We have a list.
Or no, we don't. Mr. Bryant, I think, was first. And then I don't know who's here for the community colleges. That group. Okay, we'll hear from you next. Thank you. And did you have someone else with you?
Just me.
Just you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Neil Bryant, and I'm a consultant to the State Board of Higher Education. I use that term rather than say lobbyist, but I am their registered lobbyist. In my real life, I'm an attorney in Bend, and I have the privilege of serving in the Senate for 8 years from Central Oregon. So it's hard not to vote every time I I want to raise my voice. Today I've been asked to provide some comments on the corporate minimum, and I'd like to begin by saying that it's clear there's support for higher education, and from the governor, from the legislature, both Republicans and Democrats, and from the business community, too. Businesses realize the importance of higher education because they've experienced it themselves. The owners usually have or their children or their families, and, of course, for their employees. There is a need, and it's a benefit. And you're aware of what it means to the state, relying so heavily on the income tax. If you receive a degree, you earn considerably more money, and you pay a lot more in taxes. You're also generally a better citizen. You have more time to take care of your family and volunteer in the community. You fall into social service needs less frequently. So it's just a great return on investment when people can invest in higher ed. Unfortunately, that isn't always the case for the state, and it depends on what revenues are available. But I don't think there's any misunderstanding any longer about the need. And if you've followed the press coverage in particular, that has helped a great deal to explain and to be a good advocate not only for higher education at the university level but also community colleges. When the co-chair's budget came out, I was asked to begin a discussion with business representatives and also business in general about what their response was to raising the corporate minimum if the funds could go to higher education. And so I asked questions, had a discussion, and here's some of their responses. First of all, they wanted to know what the corporate minimum would look like. They weren't going to sign on or agree to anything until they understood it. And if it was a simple indexing from $10 using CPI to $125 or $135, that's pretty easy to explain. And generally, there wasn't shock or disdain about that. And that, as my understanding, that would raise $30 to $40 million a biennium. But they said, okay, but what's the purpose of this money? What would it be used for? And if it's going to be used for higher education, including community colleges, how can you guarantee it's going to be used for that? And that's always a challenge for the legislature, because you can make it a designated fund for one biennium, but you can't bind future legislators. So that was a concern. And if in the future higher ed or community colleges needed more money, well, then the tactic be to go back and raise the corporate minimum again in order to find that dollars. And they weren't very keen on that strategy, thinking it's the responsibility of the state to find the revenue and to tax fairly. Some said, well, you know, it looks like there's 20% increase in revenues. Isn't that enough to fund it? Is there a need for more? Is it sustainable? With our current tax structure, it doesn't seem like many of our programs are sustainable, because every 10 years you fall into a recession. And historically, we seem to do that about every decade. And we're heading into 2011. And so that was a concern. And that leads into a discussion about, you know, what is our revenue policy and our taxing structure for the state of Oregon, and does it really make sense? I will declare in advance, in 1993, I voted for the sales tax. I was one of the five Republicans in the Senate that supported the sales tax, and that money was going to reduce property taxes and go to education, primarily K-12. And the House was Republican at that time, and the Senate was Democratic, and Barbara Roberts was the governor. And we decided to ask Oregonians that question, and it was months of hearings, good discussion, and the Republicans in the Senate agreed to provide five votes for the sales tax, and I was one of those votes. But I supported it, and I was happy to do that. It turned out I was the only Republican east of the mountains or south that supported it. So during the campaign, I had unlimited speaking opportunities. And people come to Central Oregon anyway for different things, and they always wanted to have a debate about the sales tax. I lost every one of those debates. I think people still like me. But the final outcome was statewide, 27% voted for the sales tax. However, in Deschutes County, we had 29%. And I take credit. But I think it's a different discussion now with our population changes. The property tax issue has been solved by the other initiatives and what the legislature has done. By the way, I sat on revenue in 97 when we had to implement property tax relief. And that was one of the most difficult things I'd ever gone through in my life. We called it Groundhog's Day because every day it was the same discussion in revenue. So I know how hard your jobs are, too. But the other things that come up in those discussions are, okay, is there going to be a change in capital gains as part of this? We'd like to reconnect to the death tax. We understand there's tax credits that are being discussed. So you can just see it's a broader discussion. I think the good news is that people want to have that discussion. I think the business community feels a bit threatened because they don't want to face an initiative action on it. So my conclusion would be certainly higher ed can use the money, and so can community colleges. We're on a 10-year plan. This is from the board level, to dig ourselves out of the hole that we placed ourselves in. We became a very high tuition state and low support state for students, and it's really hurt us. This was the first step, the first two-year step in that 10-year direction, and we're hopeful when the final budgets come out that they'll be good and we can move forward the next 2 years. But right now it's late in the session to do this. And it's going to take a lot of discussion. Also, with the revenue forecast yesterday, it's a harder sell. But you need to have the discussion, the hearings that involve everybody to find out both the intended and the unintended consequences of any change in the tax structure. And as I said, I think business pays for higher education now with their taxes. I mean, S-Corps, LLCs, that's just a pass-through. And so there's a feeling there that they already support higher education with the taxes they pay. But, you look at one of the things at risk is our corporate income taxes going down. Well, there might be something here that could level that out a little bit so the risk isn't as great by having some sort of a corporate minimum. It will just take a little time, and that might be the interim. It might be something that's ready for the session in February. But I encourage you to have the discussion because be successful. I think business has to be on board, and I know you want them on board. It just makes your life easier. So those are my thoughts, and I hope they're helpful.
Thank you. Questions? You were here in 97.
I was.
And I think, if I recall correctly, that was the year of the big cliff for higher education. When Measure 5 had fully phased in, we were trying to reallocate funding for K-12, which meant the state had to cut everything else, including the university system. And I know from where I sat watching in Eugene, I watched Dave Frohnmayer do some magic tricks to pull students at full tuition out of California when Berkeley was going through its core class crisis. What can you tell us about what the legislative decisions were at that time and how they may have led to this hole that you described a minute ago that will require 10 years for us to dig out of?
In 1990, of course, Measure 5 passed, and that's changed forever how we financed K-12 education in Oregon. And at that time, I think the general fund was providing like 29% of school fund for K-12, and now you're close to 75-80%. And the measure said that the legislature would replace the revenue, and they'd do it over this phase-in period. And of course, the legislature tried to do more than that. Now, the benefit we had after 1993 is the economy improved. It was robust, and we had additional revenues. But we made a decision that we could raise tuition, allow campuses to do that, and it would be somewhat painful, but that was an alternative that higher ed had that K-12 didn't, and it was in the Constitution. So that was our direction. We didn't anticipate, I don't think, that you'd have to raise tuition as much as you would. And, of course, it continued. In 1999, we made a conscious effort to help higher ed. We gave them approximately, gift isn't right, we allocated to them an additional $120 million over and above what the governor had recommended because we knew we had students coming from high schools that needed a college education in Oregon. And so we then switched to what was called the RAM model from the VAST model. And with that $120 million, that investment, suddenly higher education over the next few years increased. There were 15,000, 20,000 more students there than in the past. And if you watch our demographics, that's what happened. What's happened now, because there were further cuts again in 2000 and 2001, 2003, and so it's leveled off. Tuition has gone up not as dramatically because you bought down the tuition increase last time. And aid is going up through OSAC and the Oregon Opportunity Grant. But we probably lost a generation of Oregonians who couldn't afford to go to school. Or if they wanted to go, it was harder to get into classes. And you find that when the economy is good and you can earn $10 or $12 an hour versus going into debt to get a higher education, people who are 20, 21, and 22 will probably go with the money rather than with the debt. Not all of them, of course. And so it's created the perfect storm. And this is an attempt to begin the process to dig ourselves out of it. But it's going to take us 10 years. And then after 10 years, we'll be in the medium of other states. That's our goal. And you might say you need higher aspirations, but we're trying to be realistic as far as what the state can afford.
Where are we now? Among those other states you mentioned.
We are very low. I'm trying to remember. You look at different ways of measuring. I think you're all aware that on affordability we have an F. And other states have an F too, but I think the last information I saw, we were like 46 on affordability, maybe 48th. And then on what the state puts in support of college education, we were also in like the 45th spot. So we're not doing very well on a national comparison. The campuses, I think, have done well in the way they've tried to do things to economize. I mean, class sizes are larger. We use more part-time employees. But that affects the quality of education.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question that starts a little bit with a reflection. Earlier in your testimony, in talking about the proposed corporate minimum tax updates, that kind of a discussion, that perhaps that's more difficult now given the revenue forecast yesterday and how late we are in session. I'm tumbling that around in my mind with other information, like we've been talking about this for a while. There's generally been a commitment from all parties that just based on its structure, there needs to be a change. And then I'm thinking about the numbers that you were just sharing, how far behind we are in our higher education community college investments, knowing that the $152 million in revenue that we heard about yesterday can't begin to plug those holes, even with the lion's share of that revenue going towards community colleges at the expense of, I mean, in the co-chair's press release, there was no attention to human services. Certainly there's still the question about the troopers. I'm just concerned that we don't leave this room with the perception that yesterday's revenue forecast gave us a surplus of revenue that gives us the ability to solve all the problems in the world or even make whole our community college and higher education system. So I'm wondering, is the higher ed system feeling like yesterday was that solves the problem, that's good enough, and we should go home, or is there a commitment and interest in moving forward to correct some of our structural inequities to provide a more stable base and try to dig out of the hole that we're in higher ed as well as in some of our other important state services?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative, my comment was the perception more of the public,
okay,
that there's a 20-21% increase in the funds that are available. And that they're saying, isn't there enough in those funds then to do what you need to do without raising taxes? And it's position of the Oregon University system that even with the increased revenue and with the revised co-chair's budget, it does not solve the higher education problem in Oregon and the other issues that you talked about. So this is Neil Bryan as an individual. We have a tax structure problem here.
And just a quick follow-up.
Please.
I think one of the great unsung stories of yesterday when we talk about the increase in 20% of the budget is that part of that 10% of that budget, a little bit more than 10% of that, is being given back to taxpayers in the form of a tax cut and the corporate or the personal kicker that's being sent back that makes up over 10% of that 20% of additional revenue. So that's certainly not available to pay for those programs and services, including higher education.
No, and Mr. Chair, Representative, the individual kicker, I know there's some discussion about capping it and trying to use a portion of it for other purposes. I don't know what the conversation with Oregonians would result in as far as if you've referred that out. But it's, again, a discussion that's worth having. I'll have to say this. I was, when the vote came on the Senate floor, when I was there to refer out whether or not to put the individual kicker into the Constitution, I voted no. I thought that should be a legislative decision. But I was in the minority that day.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Bryant, I guess, you know, this whole discussion has kind of an Alice in Wonderland feel to me, and I kind of have to pinch myself because it just seems ludicrous to me that we have this $10 corporate minimum tax, and if you stopped, you know, 100 people out on the street in downtown Salem, I would warrant that at least 95, if not more of them, would express disbelief that we even have a corporate minimum that's $10 and hasn't gone up since 1931. And it seems to me if we gave voters a chance to take any version that's been proposed in this building of changing that and then, you know, dedicating the money or putting the money to any of these uses, whether it's affordable tuition or fixing the crumbling buildings or faculty salaries or community colleges or whatever, that people would overwhelmingly support it. And I guess, you know, I would just ask you, reflecting on your time on the Revenue Committee or what you've seen in the meantime, good times, bad times, we seem incapable of solving this problem. And I'm wondering, is it really that we've got some structural problems in the way the legislature operates in revenue matters? Do we just need to go to the voters now with every change and let them decide? Because I'm, frankly, having served on the Revenue Committee my freshman session in 99 and again now, it just feels like we can't deal with these problems.
Referring to the people, generally, not all the time, but frequently, it always felt that I'd failed as a legislator. You know, that's the responsibility of everybody here who's elected, to try and find those compromises. And maybe as a last resort, it goes out. But it should be used very sparingly, because that's what you've been elected to do. And would an indexing pass? You'd have a better possibility of passing that because it's simple and easier to understand. If you go to the New Hampshire plan and the value-added tax, that'll be more complicated and more difficult, and there could be, you know, opposition run to it. And it's easy to defeat a measure that increases taxes because Oregon is sensitive on those issues. I think having a further discussion about the corporate minimum, tying in these other things, are important. I don't think that's happened yet, because most of the people I talked to knew it was out there, but as far as really taking a look at it, seeing how it impacted them or their friends or others or groups, they haven't done that yet. So my preference would be for a further discussion about it. Put something out there to be discussed. And make sure, I was always a policy guy. It should be good policy. Tax policy, whatever, you have to start there rather than we need to raise this amount of money. And then all the discussion and the compromises that take place in good legislation should take place. But I think you can get there. It's just gonna take some more time. I would not recommend sending it out now.
Thank you. Good answer.
Thank you very much. Representative Byrne.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You had asked Senator Bryant earlier what the Oregon numbers were, and I just threw this out here because I was carrying it with me by coincidence today. Oregon ranks 46 among states for per-student public funding of higher education, so 46 of 50. Oregon ranks 46 among states for college affordability. And the telling number here is that for us to reach the national average, not to exceed, not to be, you know, top 10% or top 20%, just to merely reach the national average would be $265 million per biennium, so pushing $300 million. It's also important to know, as we're talking about what the specifics are, we pay our professors in the bottom quartile nationwide.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Other questions for Senator Bryant? Thank you, sir. We appreciate your coming and providing us additional information.
Well, on behalf of the system, the good news is you still have a system. It's got 82,000 students in it, and everyone's trying.
Thank you.
We appreciate your hard work.
And I'm before you leave, I just remembered the last question I wanted to ask. I also sit on the Ways and Means Subcommittee for Education. And in that committee, we have heard from a number of students and others who have come in and basically said the core program is not adequately funded. And the reason we believe that, they say, is that it's impossible for us to get the classes we need in order to graduate in 4 years. Could you say anything about that issue?
Yes. There have been cuts. And when I went to school, you could anticipate graduating in four and a half years. And certainly there were problems in getting into certain classes, but you know, it would be offered again the next semester, and you could get in, or you go talk to the prof and say, I need this for my major. Can you let me in? Can't do that anymore. Our class sizes are large. Our classrooms are full. Many of them are outdated. We know about the deferred maintenance of $680 million. And so students might have to wait a year to get into that class that they need to graduate. And that's a common problem. And we'd like to do better in that regard, but that takes an additional investment.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Community colleges are here. Great to see you today.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association. And I have with me today Mary Skildy, who's the president of Lane Community College, and Mary brought with her one of her business partners, Jim Torrey from Eugene, to also speak. What I would like to do first is just to give you some information on the community college budget situation, what it means, and then I will let our two other panelists talk in further detail. When we were asked to present today, obviously it was a conversation last week. Our budget situation was a little different than it is today. And what I'd like to do first is just put in perspective what the budget numbers now that were released yesterday, what they mean for community colleges, and the policy questions around our ask of $529 million and what the difference is for that. The budget number yesterday that was discussed was $493 million. It is $10 million above the governor's budget. It is a budget for community college that means that for most of our community colleges are not making cuts as they have over the last 5 years. They're not facing the situation of, you know, which programs are we going to cut this time, which classes are we no longer going to have, how many less students are we going to serve. So for most of our colleges, they are not facing that question. Instead, it's a budget that will keep them where they are now with maybe some slight minor investments that they might be able to do. That's with the exception of two of our colleges, and that's Lane Community College and Rogue Community College. For both of those colleges, this budget still is a significant cut budget for those two colleges, and will be making cuts in the next year's budget that will have implications for both for higher tuition and will be serving less students. Community colleges, you had asked about the whole for the university system, and I want to speak a little bit about the whole for community colleges and how we got to this spot. Community colleges like K-12, a large part of our funding was from property taxes, and 50% of our funding prior to 91 came from property taxes. With that loss, the legislature made up some of the money, but community colleges have never really been able to get the funding that they needed to serve the students. I think the policy question really for the the committee to look at is what does the future look like for community colleges? And I wanted to throw out a couple of outside reports that have looked at post-secondary education in Oregon. One of them is the Education Commission on the States, and they did a survey of the participation gap in across the United States and did a state-by-state analysis and essentially recommended that by the year 2015, Oregon needs to serve an additional 108,000 students in post-secondary education. Now, that's not just community colleges, but the university system as well, including our private schools. We're a long ways away from serving that many more students. We also know from information from WICHE, the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, that Oregon is one of 13 states in this country right now where the older generation is more educated than the younger generation, that essentially Oregon's heading the wrong direction. And that is a trend that we're very concerned about. Here in Oregon, we have information from various groups that have talked about a goal of having 40% of Oregonians with a bachelor's degree, 40% with an associate's degree, and 20% with a high school diploma. And that we also know from the Employment Division that by the year 2014, there are 660,000 jobs that will need to be filled. So our concern as community colleges is how do we move to the place where we're making an investment in post-secondary education so we can meet those needs. And so with that, we did pass out some information that you have today. It's a sheet that looks like this. And these are our professional technical programs. This was done by our colleges that we essentially asked the question, you know, if the colleges were to receive $529 million, what are the professional technical programs that could be added? Now, when this was developed, it was the difference between the governor's budget of $483 and $529. So certainly some of these programs on here at a budget level of $493 could be offered, but just a few of them. And I'd be happy to get some information on what that might look like. I don't have it as of today. But these are all programs that businesses need around the state, that there are job openings, and that, you know, with additional resources, these programs could be started so that approximately 4,000 Oregonians could be served by these programs that would train them for jobs that are out there. So given all that, really our message to you is that we hope that you continue the conversation about a corporate minimum or other ways to fund post-secondary education, and that we hope that whatever discussion is done in conjunction with the business community. A large part of our mission is serving the business community. We want to make sure that they're successful and that hope that they can be partners in developing what other type of reform we have to the tax structure. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Mary Spilde to talk specifically about Lane Community College.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Spilde, president of Lane Community College. I just want to share a little bit about the challenges that Lane is facing. The disinvestment that we've experienced over the last several years is really having very serious effects on our ability to serve our community. Our community colleges are all at different places in their budget cycle. For example, I know that Shemeketa Community College has already cut over the last 5 or 6 years about $21 million from their budget. At Lane, we've cut about $14 million from our budget. And this year, based on the governor's budget, we'll cut another almost $6 million. That's from a $75 million budget. We're receiving 20% less from the state than we did in 2001. It really is putting in serious jeopardy our ability to serve our community and our businesses. It particularly impacts our career and technical programs. And those are the programs that prepare people for family wage jobs. They're the most expensive for us to offer, and therefore they're the most at risk given our financial situation. In fact, in our reduction list of that almost $6 million, we have 15 faculty positions coming from our programs, and that's in addition to 25 unfilled vacancies where we'll use more part-time that are on our cut list. And if it weren't for the fact that our faculty have stepped up and have agreed to give back raises and make other concessions for next year, those programs would already be gone. But this is just a one-year short-term fix. Next year, we'll be right back where we are. In addition to the 15 faculty positions, we are laying off 25 support staff. That's in addition to the 37 that we laid off last year. And we're cutting over $1 million in part-time faculty. That represents hundreds of sections of courses that we will no longer be able to offer, which means that students will have less choice and will take much longer to degree. This disinvestment is also affecting our ability to serve our partners in the community. For example, we can't expand our programs in high-need areas like auto tech and nursing. Peace Health, one of our hospitals in the community, needs 120 nurses a year. We graduate 81. There's no way that we can, and that's our expanded program, and that's with the help of about $250,000 from Peace Health to allow us to train more nurses. We simply can't meet the need. The same is true in auto tech. It's great demand, high-wage jobs, $60,000 to $80,000 a year. We can't meet their need for trained employees. We also can't make the right connections with our high schools. Many of our high schools have eliminated their professional technical programs. We have tried to step in by developing a regional technical education consortium, but it's just not funded, and we don't have the resources to fund it. It takes capacity to make these partnerships work. We need staff to work with the high schools, and we simply have no resources to spare. It's also affecting our capacity to work with business. While businesses pay for customized training, it takes a significant amount of time to develop those training programs. That also takes staff capacity, which we simply don't have. And these kinds of things are happening in Eugene and in Medford, that is served by Rogue Community College. These are the second and third largest metro areas in Oregon. And I don't know how we can expect Oregon as a whole to be competitive with this level of disinvestment. Community colleges are can-do kinds of places, and that's why I love to work at a community college. We generally figure out a way to make things work, regardless of the funding that we receive. But I'm increasingly pessimistic that it is impossible to make things work any longer. We just can't make it work. At the $529 million level, there is much we could do to help develop healthy communities and healthy economies. But certainly at the governor's level and even at the 493 level, it's impossible to do what needs to be done. At Lane, we're on a path to fiscal sustainability. We've set up revenue-generating programs. We have been strategically growing over the last 2 years. But we need that 529 from the state to make fiscal sustainability possible in the next 2 years. If it stretches out more than 2 years, I don't really see any hope, because we'll just keep on this downward cycle of cutting. We can't look to tuition any longer. We've increased tuition 92% since 2001. As was mentioned, Oregon is 46th in per-student spending on higher education. Oregon is truly the poster child for disinvestment in higher education, and I don't think this is what we want for Oregon. There are alternatives to reverse this situation. It really comes down to whether we have the will to reverse the situation, and I fervently hope that the will is there, because the future of, I think, our community colleges generally, but certainly Lane Community College, is going to depend on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Curry.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm here today, frankly, to support Lane Community College specifically, but I'm here to talk about two things. And from my perspective outside...
And if you would, please identify yourself for the record.
Oh, excuse me. My name is Jim Torrey, and I'm former mayor of Eugene, and as of yesterday, a new member of the 4J school board.
Congratulations.
It was a tough campaign, but nobody else ran, so I won. And I brought my BlackBerry along, but it is off. But I brought it because it reminded me of where I was 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, I was in Ireland. And I spent 2 weeks in Ireland visiting that country, because it's roughly the size of the state of Oregon. 300,000 more people live there than live in Oregon. And it's a developed country, and it's a very successful country, but they have done a much better job of preparing their young people, those people who are not traditionally four-year college-bound students, for the future. And while I was there, I visited not only educational facilities, but manufacturing facilities. One of them happens to be the largest manufacturer or distiller of whiskey. Now, in Ireland, that's saying something. While I was going through the tour, there was a young man from India there. Last year, or 2 years ago, I actually visited India and visited schools there to see how they educate their students. The gentleman from India was there as a company representative to identify how he could take that company, Jameson Distilleries, and convert it from a heavy dependence on employees to a more computerized basis. And they would do that work in India and provide the service to the owners of the company in Ireland. Now, I bring that up because I haven't seen, looking from the outside in, that we've identified in this legislative session the need to prepare those young people who are not going to be college-bound students. The community colleges are our best opportunity to do that. Just last week in Washington, D.C., there was a huge discussion about something called the silent epidemic. And the silent epidemic recognizes that 74% of the kids who start high school in this country will not graduate on time. In Oregon, we're less than 70%. Now, this is not dropout rates. This is talking about kids who won't graduate 4 years after they start. I'm here, though, today to ask you not to give up on discussing the corporate minimum tax and dealing with what we all seem to talk about before the session and then seem to walk away from during the session. I'm not here to suggest that there's a specific way to deal with it, but this committee, when all of you are sitting at this table, is really a well broad-based committee. I think you can have that discussion, and I urge you to do it. I don't know who else is going to take care of these young people, and not only just the young people, because if the people in India and the people in China are preparing to take those jobs that they can do by computer in their countries, we are going to be negatively impacted in this state. And so when you talk as a business person, and I am a business person, about a willingness to deal with the corporate minimum, it's because there is something in it for all of us. And the ability to make sure that our people are prepared and properly trained, and I'm talking about all of our people, is a significant economic development interest for the state of Oregon. I would hope that you folks would not leave this session, and particularly this committee would not leave this session without furthering the discussion and the need to deal with the inequity, at least the perceived inequity. And Representative Rodenbaum, I absolutely agree with you. I think it's probably 99% of the people can't believe the situation. But without taking sides on what the change ought to be, don't walk away from the discussion. Find the common areas of agreement and then expand it from there. But don't walk away from the discussion. We can't afford to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor Tory. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your presentation very much. And Mr. Bryant, did you have some more things you wanted to offer today? I was told you might.
I was
I think you've been, Mr. Chair, Neil Bryan again, I believe you were handed a budget reconciliation form.
Yes.
And this is...
The fine print.
The fine print, and I've had to put on my glasses. This does a very good job of showing what was requested by the Oregon University System, and that's the board, then the governor's recommended budget, and you can see the differences there. The May revised co-chair's budget, which is a significant improvement from the original co-chair's budget, and you can see the difference between the governor's and the co-chair's. And as I said, even though the co-chair's revised budget is a significant step in the right direction, it still is also significantly less than the governor's recommended, and then less than what the board felt was necessary to begin this 10-year process for higher ed. The area that I can't talk to you about in very much detail is the capital portion of it, because we haven't gotten the detail yet from the co-chairs on what they mean by and how they would use G-bonds, lottery bonds, et cetera, in the capital construction portion of it. But you'll notice that's a significant part of the differences between the two. But this shows you, and what the board was trying to do when they said we need to reduce student-faculty ratio, class sizes have gotten bigger. That's what you do when you make cuts. And that then does not improve the quality of your education. And so they wanted to improve that. That meant hiring more faculty, and probably more full-time faculty, less part-time, because there's a benefit to that. Faculty salaries. Faculty had a two-year wage freeze, and we're behind. It's harder to hire good faculty when you compete nationally. And so that was another factor that was emphasized there. And then enrollment growth. We want to, the university system, teach more kids, but there has been no money for enrollment growth in our budget since 1999. So this is a very good worksheet for you that shows what has been funded and what hasn't been funded, and will, I'm sure, be referred to frequently as we go through the Ways and Means process.
Thank you very much. Now, this is going to be to study, but are there any questions now on the worksheet? Thank you. We appreciate your introducing us this to us. And now what I'd like to do is proceed to Chris's part of the information meeting today, and a discussion of one of the proposals that, or actually a series of the proposals that we have been looking at. So, Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in your packet there you have three pieces of paper pertaining to what is being called the corporate minimum activity tax. And the first one I want to point your attention to is actually a tax return from New Hampshire. If you recall, during some of the corporate minimum discussions earlier in the session, you heard a lot of testimony with concern about having a minimum tax based on sales and gross receipts. And so following that up, looking for alternatives to a gross receipts-based minimum tax, we turned our attention to New Hampshire, which has what they call a business enterprise tax. It's essentially a value-added tax where the base of the tax is wages, dividends, and interest. And you can see on the one side that has the entire tax form, so this is kind of the postcard tax form for this particular tax. And New Hampshire doesn't have an income tax. They have a business profits tax that is tied in with this, but we were focusing on the structure of this tax as a possible way to incorporate into the corporate excise tax as an alternative minimum tax. And the calculation is pretty straightforward. You have compensation and wages paid by the company to New Hampshire employees, and then you have dividends paid out by the company, and then you have interest paid or accrued, and that represents the value-added tax base. And then you simply have a tax rate applied to it. So that was the base that we started with. And then we took that information and tried to come up with some estimates on what it would raise for the state of Oregon. And to that end, you have if I could turn your attention to a different sheet, called Considerations for 21st Century Revision of Oregon Corporate Minimum Tax. This sheet has a couple of the options that had been proposed earlier in the session. Those were those gross receipts minimum taxes. You have an option A and option B. The option A was contained in House Bill 2217, and that came from the governor's office, and that raised about $84 million in the 07-09 biennium. And there was option B that raised about $153 million that was discussed earlier in the session related to House Bill 2031. And so with that as a framework, options C, D, and E are bases for the value-added tax. And just to describe each of those briefly, option C, I should probably mention, each of these also contains a fee from the Secretary of State filing, and an increase in that fee. Currently, entities pay a $50 fee to register with the Secretary of State. This would increase that amount. That would be a source of some of the revenue. So option C increases that fee by $135, and that would raise $28 million. But the CMAT piece of that, it would be a 0.175 rate with no cap and no exemption, and that would raise about $113 million.
Now, just to be clear about this, we're really talking about 175 thousandths of 1%, aren't we?
Yes, it is.
So these numbers are actually have to put two more zeros in front of that, don't you?
Yes.
Thank you.
It's 0.175%.
Right. A quite a bit lower rate than the rate New Hampshire charges.
Yeah, New Hampshire charges
three-quarters of 1%.
Three-quarters of 1%, and this is less than two-tenths of a percent in this case. And the revenue impact there is about $113 million. Option D, aside from changing the $135 fee, the CMAT would increase the rate slightly to 0.2%, and again, have no cap and no exemption, and that would be $130 million. And option E increases the rate to 0.5%, so it's still less than the New Hampshire rate for frame of reference, but it includes a $25,000 cap. So whatever the base is, the base times that rate, once that hits $25,000, that is the most that this tax would be. It also includes a $50,000 exemption, so that base amount, that's kind of like a standard deduction, so the first $50,000 for each of the taxpayers is excluded from this calculation.
So even though it's a much higher rate, it collects less money.
It collects money for those with the smallest base, they're paid zero, and those at a certain level, they're capped at $25,000.
Right. Thank you.
And then to that end, on the third sheet of paper, if you flip it over to the chart, these are two graphs of options C and E. Options C and D are pretty similar, so I'm trying to focus on two that were different. Options C and E, and the big differences being there, the issue of whether there's a cap or the exemption. And again, the three parameters you could play with in these models are the tax rate, whether or not there's a cap and at what level the cap would be, and to the extent that there would be an exemption amount. So the graph here shows options C and E, and option C is the dashed line. We can see that pretty much goes straight up, and that's in line with it's a kind of a flat rate tax. So whatever the base is, it's just multiplied by just under 0.2%, and that's the tax. The solid line shows option E, which exempts the first $50,000, and then we have that 0.5 tax rate, and so that goes up much higher between the base of $0 to just over $5 million. And that's where that line tops out, and then it just goes over to the right. And that's the arrow, the 5.05 million. The 05 is the exemption of the 50,000, and then the 5 million times the half a percent rate gets to that level. And then you can see where the two intersect again is at about 14.3 million. That's where the option C, the 0.175% rate, finally reaches the $25,000 mark. So that means under option C, companies with a $14.3 million base, that's where they hit that $25,000 mark. And then again, for option C, the line just continues to go up at a constant rate because it's just a flat tax, if you will.
So, and just to make certain we understand, this is the CMAT base is not sales, it's labor and the cost of capital.
Yes.
Right.
It's that value-added approach, which is much more stable over the long term. Wages are much more stable than corporate profits. So incorporating this into the excise tax, and again, this is an alternative minimum tax, and we're going to get to some examples here in a minute.
Okay.
But it does add that level of stability to the corporate tax and that value added.
Any questions so far? Go ahead.
Okay, on the other side, there are eight examples, and we don't have to walk through all of these. I'm not trying to torture anybody.
and you know what might be useful later when you have a little more time is to pull these examples apart and demonstrate where they come from. I mean, what kind of businesses you were trying to describe.
Okay.
Not today, obviously, but at another time Oregonians can understand a little better what we're talking about.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The intent here was to try and show how this would interact with the corporate excise tax. So the first example is now these are all just corporate excise tax corporations, those that pay the current $10 minimum. Example one, we have a corporation that has $100,000 of taxable income, so their gross tax is $6,600, just the 6.6%. And in this particular case, they have $6,300 in credits that they're able to use. So their corporate excise tax is $300. Now, under option C and E, we can see here that their CMAT base is their wages and the interest and dividends, so that their CMAT base is $210,000. And under option C, the 0.175%, their CMAT tax would be $368. And so comparing the $368 to the $300, their total excise tax would then be $368. So the impact of the CMAT, if you will, is $68. So it would increase their tax by $68. Option E, there's, again, it's the same CMAT base, but with those other parameters, the different rate, the exemption, and the cap, their CMAT tax would be $800, and so that would be their tax, and the impact from the CMAT would be $500. Skipping ahead to example three, and of course I see a mistake that I made. The excess tax is actually $10. Is it the $10 minimum that's on there? It shouldn't be zero.
Okay. And that would be for both examples.
That would be for both examples. Okay. All the examples, the minimum excess tax should be $10, and so that happens in a few of the other examples. In this case, we have a company, a C corporation, with taxable income of $3 million. They have gross tax of $198,000, again, just that 6.6%. And in this case, they have $500,000 of credit. So on the excess tax, they essentially eliminate their tax, or down to the $10. And this company has $5 million in wages and $2 million in interest and dividends, so their CMAT base is $7 million. And I should probably add, at this point, I talked to the Department of Revenue to try and get a reality check on the wage level for the taxable income levels to try and line those up, and they really are all over the map. So it's really difficult to come up with an example that represents an entire class of corporations because there's so much variance. I mean, I fixed the taxable income here, but then coming up with the wage and interest base, they really are all over the map. But these are fictional examples. These are not real companies. So with that CMAT base of $7 million, option C would result in a CMAT tax of $12,250, and so that would be their tax. And then option E, this is a company that maxed out at the $25,000. The base exceeds that $5 million mark from the chart, so they're going to be paying the $25,000, so that would be the impact for them. Option four is a little bit different in that we still have that same $3 million company, $198,000 tax, but in this case they only have $180,000 of credit, so they still have an excise tax liability of $18,000. And this company has a wage base of $18 million and $2 million of interest and dividends. So here, the difference, this company has a much higher wage base, so in that sense it's less profitable for the amount of labor and input that they use. And in this case, their CMAT tax for option C is $35,000. Again, that's just the 0.175% rate. And then option E, it's maxed out at the $25,000. So since this is an alternative minimum tax, the total tax for the option C is $35,000, which comes from the CMAT. And for option E, it's the $25,000, also from the CMAT. But the impact of the CMAT for company C is an increase of $17,000, which is the difference from the $18,000 from the corporate excise tax to the $35,000. And then in option E, it's a $7,000 increase because they hit that maximum.
Okay.
And again, jumping ahead, unless people want me to go through all of them.
Okay.
Example six.
Well, it might make sense just to describe what a business like that might be. I mean, this is a business with a relatively large activity level. Example four.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have one that is likely to have a high gross sales, relatively low activity level, but perhaps based on the fact that they buy a lot of goods to sell? Do you have an example of that kind of a business?
So high activity, low margin?
No, the other way around. Well, low margin and low activity because they, like a gasoline dealer or a grocery store that has very high costs of goods sold, doesn't have to process them very much, but has high sales because they have to collect the cost of their goods sold.
I didn't really incorporate the cost of goods sold into this. It's not part of the tax base. So that's
right.
That's
that was one of the criticisms
base.
Of the other tax, option A and B on the other side of the page. That was one of the criticisms of those taxes is because they tax you whether you had any real, whether you did anything real or whether you simply were a pass-through company.
And in this case, in these cases, because it's a different base, I didn't add that information here to specifically show that. I certainly can add that. Mm-hmm. The idea here is in order for them to have be affected by the CMAQ, they need to have a significant activity of the wages and the labor.
Right. Thank you. Go ahead. You got another example or two you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I'll jump to example six, which is a company with $50 million in taxable income. So we're talking about large companies there, and they have $100 million in wages and small interest in dividends. So, again, a large employment, but they are very profitable. And in this case, their gross tax is $3.3 million, and they use $2 million in credit. So they're paying $1.3 million in taxes. And this is an example of a company that would not be affected by the CMAQ because they're paying a fairly sizable amount in the excise tax.
In the current tax,
that we already collect, they would not be affected by that. Examples 7 and 8 were examples of lost companies, which in many respects can be analogous to a company that offsets all of their gross tax with credits, because the bottom line is that they have their excise tax is just the $10. Mm-hmm. And in these cases, it's a relatively small base here with respect to the value added. The example 8 I included because this is another equilibrium point, if you will, in between the option C and E. Here, when the CMAT base is about $77,000, the CMAT tax would be identical. That's where those two functions line up. So I included that because I couldn't show on the graph where those two lines intersect because it happened so early, mm-hmm, with respect to the tax base.
So this could be Representative Butler's theoretical grain elevator with several $1 million in actual sales, a very small net loss, and a couple of employees who, mm-hmm, run the place, and they would end up paying $135.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Whereas on the gross sales tax, they'd be paying in the thousands of dollars.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Questions or comments about these examples that Chris has given us? And I've asked him already to refine these a bit as we look at this idea further. I don't see any today. Do we have some people signed up who want to be heard on this information meeting? We didn't put out a sign up per se. We did. We didn't get any. We have some people who'd like to be heard on the information meeting. Yes, sir, over here. I saw a hand. Yes, and another one over here. Why don't you two come up?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I, too, along with Senator Bryant, had an opportunity to serve in this body from 91 through 1998. So I have some perspectives on what happened back in the bad old days as well.
And you were here before I was. Would you identify yourself for the record?
I'm terribly sorry. John Watt. I represent Medford Chamber today.
Thank you.
Certainly, from the Chamber's point of view, one of the things very, very high on their agenda is more support for higher education and community colleges, because we have a recognition in our business community, certainly, that we benefit from the products that come out of these institutions, and it is extremely important. Just prior to my service in the legislature, I had a conversation with the outgoing chair of the Higher Education Board, who was Dick Hensley at that time. And one of the things that he counseled me as I came up here, he said that the way that higher education was funded at that time was essentially through a block grant, and that higher education came in, asked for a certain amount of money, and then said, essentially, we'll come back next session and tell you how we spent the money. And for the group that was coming in the early 90s, there was a very real desire for more accountability through that particular agency, in addition to some others as well. And as this is very simplified, I understand that, and it's certainly my perception, but as things worked out, certainly we're able to feel like we got the accountability that we needed from higher education just about the time that term limits kicked in and everybody went off home, and then the year 2000 came around and the economy went down in the tubes and created a great deal of the problems that we face today. So I think that with the recognition that we have a responsibility in the business community, we would also like to say, as Senator Bryant said, by the way, he's a lot calmer now than he used to be.
thank you for that information.
That these proposals need to be made on good public policy, not on just a need for immediate revenue. Our Chamber Executive Committee, in a meeting last week, sent a message up to you that they would like to see comprehensive tax reform. And I think your passage of House Bill 2530 certainly moves a long way in that direction to have that discussion. I also would like to share with you some information regarding your proposal here for the CMAT. We contacted David Juvet at the New Hampshire Business and Industry Association to ask him about this proposal. And he indicated that he wanted to make it very clear to the folks out here in Oregon that New Hampshire has no personal income tax. And in 1996, even the business community recognized that one of the problems that they were having back there is that businesses were sheltering their profits as personal income tax. And that's one of the things that really led to the implementation of the New Hampshire model. Obviously, that's not the same situation that we have out here in Oregon. It's a very, very complex proposal. I had the opportunity to serve on this committee that you're serving on in 1995, and I don't know about you, but I left these meetings with an awful lot of cobwebs and questions. As I look at the proposal that's been handed out, the nightmares continue. It will take us an awful long time to figure out just how this is going to impact our businesses. From the Medford Chamber's point of view, we would much rather see your efforts and ours, quite honestly, in dealing with a conversation about comprehensive tax reform in the state of Oregon. I might also add, as a parting comment, that in 1996 we had an interim study in this very room about taxes in Oregon. We began with the first tax that we ever enacted in this state and went up to the period through 1996 of how we were collecting taxes. I had the honor to chair that study, and at the end I asked the committee two questions. Do you think that there's a need for tax reform in Oregon? 9 people voted yes. The next question was, are you willing to put a proposal to the 1997 legislative session that would enact that reform? The vote was the same. Unfortunately, no one cared to do that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Watt. Please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Leachman with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. Thanks for considering this idea. I want to speak directly to the CMAP proposal. In addition to the benefits that Chris mentioned, this sort of proposal, unlike the previous one that you all had before you, doesn't have the steps that some considered a problem. It's a, as has been mentioned, a VAT tax, so it wouldn't have the cascading impact that Washington's B&O tax would have. That was something that was mentioned in a previous hearing. It's probably a regressive tax because it's based primarily on payroll, but we're talking about a small amount of money in the overall scheme of our tax structure. It's not going to have a major impact in terms of shifting our system to be significantly more regressive. So in that sense, the the benefits may outweigh the negatives there. It's also, you know, relatively easy tax for businesses to calculate. It's this is information that businesses generally already have on hand. I want to just focus on the cap and the question of whether or not there should be a cap. Obviously, this is something that you all have been considering, given the options that Chris laid out for you. And I just want to clarify that if you have a cap, then you're shifting the burden of the tax more towards the bottom end of business taxpayers. And there are companies in the state who have a large amount of payroll, who would benefit the most from a cap of $25,000 or $30,000 or $50,000. And to put in perspective, I mean, I think that most of us hear $25,000, $50,000 in tax and think, you know, that's a lot of tax, and for most of it is. But let's put in perspective what that means to some of our corporations. In 2005 and 2006 combined, the net pre-tax profits at Intel nationwide were $20 billion, approximately. So you all know that's larger than the general fund. And you all know that that what $25,000 means in the context of the general fund, it's really not very much money. I'll also point out that by our calculations, conservative calculations, Nike saved over $16 million in 2006 from the single sales factor alone. In the late 1990s, Intel was paying over $50 million a year in corporate income taxes. Today, they're likely to be paying close to $10. So, increasing it to $25,000 or $50,000 is really nothing compared to the over $50 million annually that they used to be paying. So, I just encourage you to as you consider.
Was that based on the multiple factor for apportionment basis?
Yeah, in the 90s,
as compared to the single factor we have now.
Yes, it was a three factor formula with a somewhat more weighting on the sales, but not we weren't all the way to single sales at that point. That's much more.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
I was just closing that as you consider the proposals before you, whatever we decide on, I think this is an intriguing proposal we'd encourage you to not have a cap and to focus on a lower rate as opposed to having a cap.
I see.
A lower rate. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
So in that sense, comparing option C and E, one has a very low rate but with no cap, and the other one has a much higher rate but a very substantial, a relatively low cap.
That's right. So if you have a lower rate, then most of the businesses, most of the businesses are going to get a lower tax. But if you can raise the same amount of revenue with a lower rate and no cap, then that's going to benefit smaller businesses as opposed to having a cap. In order to raise the same amount of revenue, you're going to have a higher rate. And so we would say that. From the perspective of smaller businesses, you know, you definitely want to. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. A new cell phone that I haven't figured out how to turn off.
Turn it off yet?
So that would be our recommendation.
Thank you. Questions for these two? They're very, very different positions, but I think that we can entertain questions for both. I guess you've either got us stumped or convinced, one or the other. Thank you, gentlemen. Do we have others who want to be heard at the information meeting today? Let me make a couple of comments about the ideas that we are talking about here. When we heard last time that we talk about these issues, about a corporate minimum tax, we were looking at option B, which is on the front of that first page. And we received a couple of basic criticisms of option B. One of them was that if you were at one of the breakpoints in the sales factor and you had one more dollar in sales, some of your taxes went up several thousand dollars or could potentially go up several thousand dollars with that $1 in sales. So we wanted to make sure that whatever proposal we made, it did not do that. And none of these proposals do that. The other thing that was raised was that when you base a corporate minimum tax on sales, you may end up in a situation where you tax high-volume, low-margin businesses at a very high level and cause problems then for gas stations, for grocery stores, for Representative Butler's mythical, but I think very real, grain elevator and other businesses of that sort. So we wanted to deal with that issue as well. And that's what the genesis was of looking at this New Hampshire model. So as, for those who might be interested, listening on, here or on the Internet, those were among the things that we were trying to address. Now, when you address two criticisms, you might very well generate others. So part of the reason why we are proposing, presenting these ideas today, not a particular plan, but a set of ideas, is to, in hopes that we can generate both support to help the state deal with its structural budget deficit and also criticism of the particular plan or particular ideas so that we can write a plan, if we get there, that will serve Oregon as best as possible. And I think with that, unless there's someone else who wants to be heard today, we'll close the information hearing and we'll get on with our work sessions on other matters. Thank you all for coming. Okay. Do I still have a quorum? I do. People have come back. Great. All right. I've got to find my agenda again, buried under all the papers. Okay, I would like to open a work session on House Bill 3047, and Mary's on that one, but I think rather than having her give us a summary, people will recognize House Bill 3047 because we sent it out of this committee to the floor, and it was referred back to the House, or back to the committee, essentially at the request of Representative Morgan, who wanted to make an addition to the bill that would allow for the federal road funds to be spent in Douglas County on patrolling the roads. As we were looking at the amendment on that bill, we realized, Legislative Council helped us to realize, that we had a problem with the relating clause, including that material in the relating clause. So it was a great idea. I was very supportive of it, and that's why I agreed that we should move the bill back to committee. But it turns out that this is not the vehicle in which we can get that little piece of work done. And therefore, I would like a motion to send the bill back to the floor so that we can accomplish the things that actually are in the bill that we've already talked about.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd move House Bill 3047 as amended back to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Brown moves House Bill 3047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? If not, please call the roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative
Butler. Excused.
Representative
Walter.
Excused.
Representative
Alton.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
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 Aye. And that motion is carried. The bill goes back to the floor with a due pass. Representative Olson, you made the motion to refer it back because you were the carrier. Are you willing to carry the thing?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Olson will carry. And we will close the work session on House Bill 3047. Second time's the charm. Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you.
We have one more bill that Mary has worked on, and that's House Bill 3455. We'll open the work session on that bill. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a final version of the Dash 4 amendment that was requested that will get the language correct. We had previously looked at this bill. It revises the definition of an urban renewal plan's consolidated billing rate to include urban renewal plans that have been substantially amended. Specifically, if an urban renewal plan is a reduced rate plan, before it is substantially amended, it remains as such after it has been substantially amended. I think it was pointed out during the session that the City of Connecticut amended its urban renewal plan, which resulted in an unintended change in its urban renewal plan designation, changing it from a reduced plan to a standard rate plan. At that point, its local option tax no longer could be set aside for its intended purpose. It became subject to division of tax. And so this amendment will basically keep it as a reduced rate plan. It says in the amendment that if the urban renewal plan was substantially amended either by adding land to the urban renewal area or by increasing the amount of indebtedness that could be issued or incurred under the plan, it remains a reduced rate plan.
Thank you. And that was the Dash 4.
That's the Dash 4, Mr. Chair.
And we think we've got it correct now. Okay. All right.
Yes, sir.
Do you want to be heard on that? No? You're happy. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I remember this discussion, and I remember this was a good idea. And I forget the date we heard it.
It was a long time ago.
April 24th. Therefore, I move the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3455.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3455. Discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 4s. The bill is amended with the Dash 4 amendments. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3455 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 3455 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Don't see any. Please call the roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative
Butler.
Excused.
Representative Gelser.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Green.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion is carried, and House Bill 3455 as amended goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We do have a unanimous vote on this bill. Is this subject to the consent calendar, or who would like to carry it?
I would be happy to carry it, Mr.
Representative Berger will carry the bill. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3455. Paul, can we go ahead on this other bill?
Mr. Chair, just in case anybody gets, too excited on the floor, we can put them to sleep with discussions of urban renewal.
Yes, that is a good point to be made. Thank you very much.
And Representative Reed suggests the next bill would work just as well.
That would work well. You could always hit them over the head with the next bill.
Injure them, yes.
And with that, we'll open a work session on House Bill 3265. Paul?
Mr. Chair, this is the rewrite of the bond laws for the state. Recall you've seen a number of versions of this, and we're getting concerned about our copier budget on this bill. But you do have a Dash 6 amendments. Mazin has been working with the Law Commission, and I think they're ready to talk about those.
Great. Someone here from the Law Commission to talk about the Dash 6. Why don't you come forward? Now, colleagues, while they come forward, I will tell you that I am informed that all of your late-night reading of the Dash 4s will not be wasted. In fact, the Dash 6s are only minor changes from the Dash 4s, and they will explain those changes to us so that it won't be necessary to reread the entire Dash 6 amendment. Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Cynthia Burns from the Attorney General's Office. I represent the state treasurer in the state's bond sales, and I was part of the work group that worked on this wonderful bill. With me, I have Harvey Rogers, who's also bond counsel to the state of Oregon and local governments, and Doug Goh, who is also our bond counsel and represents local governments. Chair Barnhart is correct. You don't have to read the whole thing again. The Dash 6s are the bill with little tweaks to them, which we thought were important tweaks, to fix some things that still needed fixing after the Dash 4s. So I'll sort of go through quickly and just tell you what the changes are, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. The first set of changes appeared in sections 662 and 109A of the bill, and all of those sections deal with how the treasurer gets paid. The treasurer's office has for many years charged for its services related to the bond sales, and all that money goes into one fund that's established in the general fund. It's called the Miscellaneous Receipts Account for the Treasurer. So this was just to make sure that the language conformed in all three of those sections to other statutes that are out there under which the treasurer gets paid for his investment officer services and for the banking services that the treasurer does. So we wanted the language to match, and now it matches. The second change is to Section 8, which deals with credit enhancements, which are like insurance for the bonds and things like that. We read this section numerous times. It had a sentence that had a lot of commas and was a long sentence, and I at least read it two different ways because of the commas. So we fixed the problem. We decided to fix it. The language is basically the same, but now instead of a series of commas and a long sentence, there's numbers and subdivisions of A, B, and C.
This is Section 8?
Yeah, that's in Section 8.
Ah.
So the language is the same, but there's a 1 up at the top, and there's a 2 and an A, B, C instead of lots of commas.
I see, but the actual wording is identical.
Yes.
Thank you. Go ahead.
In the third change we made was to sections 20 and 21, and those deal with the services that the treasurer and agencies can hire in connection with their bond sales. The first one dealt with bond counsel, and the second section deals with financial advisors, escrow people, GIC providers, investment contract providers, things like that. And we realized on our last read-through of the bill that it required an agency to pay for those services, which works great in most situations except with our conduit bond sales, where generally the agency is trying to push all the costs of that sale onto the borrower or the recipient of the bond sale proceeds. So we had to make a tweak to make sure that the agency didn't have to pay for everything and they could have the borrower or the bond recipient pay for those charges. The fourth change was really a technical one to make a phrase of revenues and other monies match all the way through two sections. They talked about a fund which holds revenues and other monies that could be used for certain purposes. There should have been parallel language in another section, and because the court will look at statutes and infer a meaning if you have one word somewhere and then you don't use the same word somewhere else. So we wanted those to be parallel, and that's what that fix was for. The final change, or I'm sorry, not the final change, the next change was also an omission that we realized on the last read-through of the bill, where there is an exception to how services are provided for the Oregon Facilities Authority. In that instance, the treasurer hires bond counsel, financial advisor, and the trustee, which is different than most agency programs. The exception listed bond counsel and trustee and didn't have the financial advisor. So that was to fix that one. And then finally, the last change was to omit additional language related to the sale of forestry bonds that simply got missed in the prior editions. It still had or allowed forestry to issue bearer bonds, or actually required forestry to issue bearer bonds, which are no longer used in the market, and also required them to record and keep track of all the bond holder names, and that just isn't done anymore. So that was an omission to take care of that. And that's the changes that from the Dash 6 amendments to the Dash 4 amendments.
Thank you. And that last one would explain, would it not, the language that we have that keeps the bondholder information secret? are not subject to public disclosure laws?
Right. It hasn't been subject to public disclosure laws for many years. And in reality, most of the records of who the bondholders really are no longer held in the state. They're with our fiscal agent or depository trust. And we contractually probably have a right to get those names, but as a practical matter, that kind of record keeping is no longer done at the state.
And in fact, we don't need them, do we? For anything?
No.
Thank you. I learned a bunch reading this bill, and it was very interesting to doing that. Questions or comments?
Comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really want to say, if we're getting close to the end, and even if we're not, how much I deeply appreciate the work that people have put into this. For the record, Mr. Chair, I'm deeply relieved that in Section 114 sub 1B that they caught that financial advisor word was missing. I caught that on my first reading, and I know you did too.
Yeah.
thank you, Representative Berger. But, I appreciate your confidence.
But really what I wanted to say was thanks to these folks who go through and actually do find those words. It's pretty impressive, actually.
Thank you. Other comments? I wanted to, now let me ask one more question. Is this thing ready to go now? We have asked the Speaker to remove the subsequent referrals of Ways and Means, which means it's going to go out of this committee to the floor, and I want some head nods to say that you're now ready. All right. And we have received a report. And I don't see a date on it, but I bet there is. Sometime May 16th. That comprehensively outlines this proposal. I have to say, and I think I said this last time we met, that I really like the idea of consolidating these laws the way you've done it. You've essentially gotten rid of one whole chapter of ORS, so that in a few years' time we'll have another chapter we can use for something else, and consolidated the laws down into two chapters. I suspect it's going to be much easier to apply and to use. You have all these kind of accreted powers and authorities that are different in every agency, consolidated and brought up to date so that bond counsel and others can figure out what each agency has the power to do and what the treasurer can do, and it simplified the whole corpus of Oregon law. And I wanted to also add that having read this bill, I'm sure I don't appreciate the effort that some very expert people went through in order to make these changes. And while recognizing you have a selfish interest in having the laws usable and easy to read, at the same time, it was a huge contribution to the state of Oregon that people have made in order to get this to us. And I want you to know that I appreciate it, and I think the committee appreciates that effort very much. Now, one other question I have, and I'm not sure this is the right panel to ask it of, were the Dash 5 amendments incorporated in the Dash 6? And I think the answer is no.
I don't think they were.
Okay. Is there someone here who can talk about the Dash 5s today? Yes. Are there other questions for this panel on the big amendment before they leave? Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much
for your work. Now, while they're coming up, let me just say the Dash 5 amendments came about as a result of the fact that this bill has the right relating clause to deal with another issue which does deal with debt, doesn't it? Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm Alex Kyler, legislative analyst with the City of Eugene. I'm pleased to have you review the Dash 5 amendments. They are actually an issue upon which Eugene and Springfield heartily do agree. This amendment relates specifically to the Metropolitan Wastewater Management Commission, which is an intergovernmental agreement agency established between the cities of Eugene and Springfield and Lane County. And we believe it's the only such entity in the state that it's a kind of a commission or a corporation of or coordination of communities to deal with their wastewater that is under this ORS 190 entity. And what happened several years ago in 2005 was that the commission went to borrow money from the DEQ under this state revolving fund for wastewater projects. And while they have the authority to borrow money from the state, the DEQ's attorneys determined that the DEQ did not have the authority to lend to such an entity. And thus, the amendment is before you today. We have cleared this amendment between the Law Commission and as well the DEQ, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you might have about it, but we'd very much hope that you do adopt the amendment to the bill.
Thank you very much. Did you want to add anything to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Aldridge, and I'm the Government Relations Manager at the Department of Environmental Quality, and I just wanted to concur with what Alex said. It is a unique commission, and because of the way the statute was written, they were excluded, and it certainly was not the intent of DEQ to have them excluded. So this would fix that problem.
Thank you. And this, as I read it, actually adds another ORS section to the bill, and includes an amendment to that ORS section. Is that your understanding? Because I don't believe this ORS 468.423 was in the bill before this.
My understanding was that it was in the first iteration of 3265.
Okay.
And but we were just adding that section B to add to the definition of public agency in ORS 190 entity.
Right. Thank you.
You know, the commission may be able to better answer that question, but as I said, I was particularly interested in the bill because I saw the definition within the first iteration of the bill.
Thank you. I don't think that section is found in the first iteration of the bill, and the reason that's important to me is because it means there's not going to be a conflict between something that's in the main bill and your amendment. So I hope the answer that I was looking for is the correct one rather than the one that you answered, and I see there's a...
But that's my understanding, is we were not amending that provision in Chapter 468 as part of the normal bill. So the changes that are made here would not conflict.
Right. And for the record, that's from the commission, that this chapter or this section was actually not in either the bill or in the -6 amendment. So adding this -5 amendment won't make any other changes in the bill, which might be a problem for us. What I'm concerned about is, can Legislative Council meld the things without a problem in preparing the final draft of the bill? And I think the answer is yes, they can. Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Thank you. What's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move this bill, but I don't know whether to move -6 or -5 first. Since the -6 is bill, we'd have to add, but we have to do the -5.
Well, I think in confirming the -6s and the -5s, the Legislative Council will use its judgment to give effect to both.
Okay.
If we move both today. Is that and Paul's giving us a nod.
Are you ready to move these?
I think so.
Well, then, Mr. Chair.
Go.
I move the -5 amendment to House Bill 3265.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the -5 amendment to Senate Bill, our House Bill 3265. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, it's so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Berger.
I move the -6 amendments to House Bill 3265.
Representative Berger moves the -6 amendments to House Bill 3265. Discussion? Very quiet. Okay. Any objection? Seeing none, it is so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move House Bill 3265 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And a request to rescind the Ways and Means
and
referral.
And a request to rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves House Bill 3265 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a rescission of the Ways and Means referral. Any further discussion? Let me just note that, for the record, that is my understanding that the intention is that we're talking now about the Dash 6 Amendment and the Dash 5 Amendment as a replacement for the bill. Any further discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative
Brown. Aye.
Representative
Butler.
Excuse.
Representative
Walker.
Excuse. Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. And the committee will be relieved to hear that I will carry the bill. Thank you.
With a wheelbarrow.
With a wheelbarrow. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3265. Do we have any other business?
Mr. Chair, we'll be there to protect you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I might need it. And with that, the committee is adjourned.